Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, an owl prowl. Almost every night since February, conservation biologist Stephanie Grossman has driven her pickup to hundreds of points on country backroads, playing owl calls till 4 a.m. She's researching the impact of forest fragmentation on raptor populations. And one cure for global warming just might be a pile of dirt. Dr. Patrick Hederachi of the University of Calgary has found a way to harness bacteria in soil and compost to turn methane emissions into carbon dioxide. And historian Dr. Sandy Gao looks back to the no-jack days in Alberta's oil patch. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The sun is just setting as I climb into the back of a pickup truck on a country road just north of Monistic School, east of Edmonton. It's a warm spring evening, and the two researchers I'm with are looking forward to a pleasant night of work. For biologist Stephanie Grossman, that means driving around the countryside till 4 a.m, listening and calling for owls. As she prepares a CD player on the cab to broadcast owl calls, her assistant Charles Levko records ambient data at our first point for the evening.
Well, we record our start time, our wind level, which we have a Beaufort scale. So I'm recording the wind as a 1 on the Beaufort scale tonight, which is just a very, very light breeze that exists. And then we record our cloud cover, the percentage of cloud cover, which tonight looks like about 0. We record our temperature, which is 6 degrees tonight, and our moon visibility, which is 0 tonight, because the moon has not come out yet, and our precipitation, which is also 0 tonight, and the noise level, which we record as low, medium, or high, and this would be a low, versus if there's a lot of dogs around or if there's traffic nearby.
This is the second time Stephanie and Charles have visited this point. Tonight, they will visit 15 points. There are 225 in the whole study area, each 1.6 kilometers apart.
Basically, we have a few, a moment of silence where we let the birds mellow out after we just drive through here, and then we play owl calls and wait for them to respond back. So we'll play a whole bunch of different species that we're looking for, and then between each call that we play, there's another minute of silence where we're actively listening for owls that are out there. And owls are, when they're breeding, they're really territorial. So when they hear another owl of the same species or even of another species, they get really agitated and the males start calling. Sometimes northern saw-whet owls will call out of control for the entire 17 minutes that we're here.
Each call is played twice, once to the north and once to the south, broadcasting for a range of 800 meters.
This is our beloved barred owl, the bird we wait for. It's our dream bird. We've only had 3, I think. The barred owl is our symbol of a good, healthy raptor community. You find them mostly in very heavily forested areas. And we've had one in Elk Island National Park. So they're few and far between, and when we hear one, we get very excited. It's very good.
This particular area where we're standing now, how would you consider it as far as an owl community goes and forest cover?
I think it's about 50% forest cover for the whole 5 by 3 kilometer area. And the owl community, basically, that we found so far is composed of northern saw-whet owls and great horns. And they are, basically, that's the community that exists anywhere between, 75% forest cover up till about 30, what we found so far. After 30% forest cover, the saw-whets drop off, and we just have great horns. And above 75%-ish, the great horns drop off, and that's when we start seeing some barred owls.
Altogether, the calls of 5 different owls are played in the 17-minute census period. Those are boreal, saw-whet, long-eared, a great gray owl, and barred owls.
At the end of each session, Stephanie grabs a large flashlight and sweeps the trees, looking for any owls that may have come towards the calls for a better look. And then it's off to repeat the whole process again at 14 more points.
Basically, what we're looking at is finding out how communities of owls and hawks, so the group of species that exists in what we are identifying as a natural landscape, so like in the national park, which is protected, how that group of owls and hawks responds to changes in their landscape. And so as forest is taken out of the landscape, how the community changes over this gradient of forest cover. So we want to know what level of forest cover, or what even what configuration, what type of fragmentation is acceptable at the landscape level to maintain what we're identifying as a healthy community of hawks and owls.
Well, just tonight we're doing an awful lot of driving, and it seems like you're going through various types of landscapes. We're right now it looks like we're on the edge of a farmer's field, mm-hmm. whereas not that long ago we were in the midst of quite heavy forest. Mm-hmm. Can you describe for me the area that you're going to be looking at? It seems like a large area, mm-hmm. and the variability.
Well, there is this area is particularly patchy, even within our high forest cover level. So we're using this Monistic Bird Bird Sanctuary and Elk Island National Park as our reference areas that we've identified as spots where there's really high forest cover, and that should be where we expect to find our healthy raptor communities. So in those areas we have essentially continuous natural landscapes, although it's not necessarily continuous forest because this area is dotted with lots of little wetlands and open grazed or browsed areas. So we have those areas which are for the most part almost entirely natural. And as you move away from the park and from the bird sanctuary, it changes very, very quickly into becoming much more patchy, and there's a great deal of agriculture in the area as well as gas pipelines.
What have you found so far?
Basically, what we've come across in the majority of our landscapes are northern saw-whet owls and great horned owls, which are almost ubiquitous throughout the landscape. And at our higher forest covers, we have barred owls. In the park, we have had a couple of barred owls and down by the bird sanctuary. And then at really, really low forest cover, we're finding, as a general rule, nothing. And a few great horned owls who are incredible. All they need is one tree to nest in, and a field to hunt in, and they're fine. So we find them, just about everywhere. But those are basically the three species that make up the community thus far.
Is there a certain level where you can or cannot find owls, where the population seems to drop off, or it tells you that it's not healthy?
Well, what has been modeled in the literature, based on mathematical models and a whole lot of theory, is that somewhere around 40% forest cover, so once 60% of the landscape has been converted to non-forest, it is expected that populations of birds will decline dramatically. And that is, the theory is that at that point, the level of fragmentation on top of pure habitat loss becomes so severe that populations just can't sustain themselves. And hopefully we will be able to try to define that threshold for raptors, so hawks and owls as opposed to songbirds, which is what most of the work has been done for in the past, and try to define empirically that threshold for raptors in this landscape, which is quite a unique landscape. So it's something that will be hopefully applicable in other landscapes as well, taking the work that we've done here and the basic framework of what we find, and other land managers in other areas will be able to use that framework to find similar thresholds in their landscapes for in terms of developing conservation strategies for raptors.
After the fifth point, I leave Stephanie and Charles, We've heard a great horned owl and a saw-whet owl. We've seen two porcupines, three deer, a moose, and we've marveled at a spectacular display of the Northern Lights. Not bad for a night's work. When it comes to greenhouse gases, methane is much more harmful to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Sources include methane leaking from landfills, as well as pipelines and well sites in the oil and gas industry. Now, a civil engineer is looking to Mother Nature for a little help in curbing these emissions. Dr. Patrick Hetarachi of the University of Calgary has developed a novel technology he calls biofiltration. In other words, percolating methane through soil or compost.
In this case, the biofiltration is used to oxidize methane to carbon dioxide. It's a matter of sending methane through a medium that holds certain type of bacteria. They're called methanotrophic bacteria. The methanotrophs can convert methane, and it uses methane as the food source and convert it to carbon dioxide.
What's this medium actually made out of?
It can be almost anything that can hold bacteria. Usually it's soil. Naturally, this occurs in every type of soil. So you can use soil, or you can use some of the material as compost, for example. The compost helps the growth of microorganisms. So compost is better than soil as a medium.
The project that you're working on now deals with trying to break down the methane that's coming from heavy oil or oil and gas. How is that working? What are you finding?
We are finding that flow rates, we can oxidize methane complete to carbon dioxide. If the flow rates are very, very high, then the efficiency of oxidation is low. So what we are looking at is sources that contain certain rate of flow. For example, if you have a site where the methane flow rate is about 100 cubic meters per day, we can pretty well oxidize everything. But if it is about 200 cubic meters per day, we can probably oxidize about maybe 60 to 70%. So the flow rate is very important.
Is this an expensive proposition?
No, it's probably very cheap because we are using this natural doctoring bacteria. And also we are using soil, and also we are using compost. Compost is also, again, something that can be generated or developed fairly easily.
Well, how do you know this biofiltration is even going to work?
Okay, I think for that we have demonstrated that in the lab. That's relatively easy, and we have to do that in the field. In fact, we have a couple of projects going on right now. We have installed one field biofilter in Lloydminster area. It's working right now, but I think, as you know, there are some limitations to this technology because in the cold winter, nothing works. So we shut down the biofilter during the cold winter, but I think what we will try to do in the future is try to keep it heated, because the microorganisms need fairly high temperatures. No, they can't work below zero anyway. So I think what we are trying to do is we try to find an easier and cheaper ways of keeping the biofilter heated during the winter time. Then it can work.
Would you use solar panels for that?
It's possible. Yes, anything is possible. But there's something called, we call waste heat in the oil and gas industry that we can use.
If there's waste heat, then how could it be used? How would it be recycled back into the process?
I think what we are trying to look at is heating it up using heating coils, and also it's quite possible that if you find the waste source, the waste heat source, we can build a biofilter next to that. So and then. Use heat exchangers to transfer the heat to the biofilter. So it has to be simple technology, because the amount of gas we can convert is relatively small at a given location, and also there's no definite revenue out of this technique, because you're converting methane to carbon dioxide. We're not getting anything out of that except that global warming benefit.
Well, what do you see down the road? Are there going to be like huge mounds of earth, these sort of biofiltration bioreactors, wherever you have a problem with the methane or how, what would it actually look like?
I say these piles of dirt, you know, we find these things anyway. I guess it's a matter of utilizing what we have out there. I think, you want to make sure, in landfills, we use soil anyway. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to use the right type of soil and right type of vegetation so we can get this additional benefit from the something that's going on already. In the oil and gas industry, yes, we may have the small biofilters at various locations depending on the emissions that they have. I really don't think sometimes they may not be seen by anybody. It's just a pile of dirt, and you know, you find piles of dirt everywhere anyway.
What are some of the problems that you're facing that you have to overcome?
Well, there are lots of problems. If you want to optimize a process, I think one of the problems we find is with most mediums, the oxidation is very fast at the beginning. With time, it levels off, and also it can reduce, it can decrease with time. So there are a number of reasons that why it happens. The bacteria produces a byproduct that can block the transfer of oxygen into the organisms that inhibits the growth of microorganisms with time. So what we're trying to do is to minimize the formation of that byproduct, and thereby trying to make sure that the oxidation does not decrease with time.
That was Dr. Patrick Hetarachi, an associate professor in civil engineering at the University of Calgary. He also coordinates the environmental engineering program there. Down in the lab, I had a chance to see some of that bacterial slime that Patrick mentioned. His research assistant, Vincent Stein, explains the experimental setup.
These are a series of laboratory-scale biofilters. They're plexiglass columns filled with a variety of types of compost we've gathered from around Alberta. On the far left here, we have leaf compost obtained from the city of Calgary. And this is a Home Depot compost, the kind you'd buy to put in your garden. It's kind of a control for us because it doesn't have any bacteria in it. And we've got composted wood chips from Weyerhaeuser. And on the far right, we've got composted municipal solid waste from the city of Edmonton. And what we're doing is just evaluating the ability of these composts to act as methane biofilters. And what we're finding is a lot of exopolysaccharide substances being formed over time in some of the composts, in particular the municipal waste from Edmonton. And what's happening is these slimes, exopolymeric substances, are inhibiting the efficiency of these biofilms, or biofilters, I should say. For instance, the city of Calgary leaf compost, you can see there's not a lot of slime in this column, and consequently it's outperforming these other ones by a factor of 10.
Why is that?
Why is it? Oh, because the slimes clog the pore spaces, and they also surround the bacterial cells, slowing the rate that the methane can diffuse to the sites of active degradation.
Well, this slime, actually, when you look at it on the column, what you see through there, it looks kind of yucky. What exactly is it?
Those are exopolymeric substances that bacteria form so that they can stick to surfaces. And they're also responsible for where you find different types of bacteria in nature. And they're also responsible for the initiation of diseases such as pneumonia and like plaque in your teeth, I guess, that causes gingivitis.
It looks like there's layers going through here. What would that be?
This here is a layer it would be a combination of bacteria and those slimes I alluded to. The amount of bacteria that gets formed is a function of a number of factors, some of which are the concentration of the gases. So down here you don't have a lot of oxygen, you're not getting a lot of microbes forming. And also here you've got a lot more slime. This is in the Edmonton Municipal Solid Waste Compost. It's got slime throughout a greater depth because for some reason there's fewer nutrients, we think. That's one thing I should mention. Tendency for these bacteria to form this slime is a function of the availability of nutrients. If you have low nutrients, nitrates and things, then you get more slime formed.
Now, what's over in these other two columns?
In the far right columns, we have soil. I think it's a loamy soil. We're trying to see how effective soil is at degrading methane. This could be used in landfill cover designs as another means of reducing methane emissions from landfills.
And how does that compare with the composted material that you've been testing?
We find certain composts, the Calgary leaves, for instance, can degrade up to 4 times as much methane as the soil can.
That was Vincent Stein, research assistant in the Methane Biofiltration Project at the University of Calgary. Before that, I spoke with his supervisor, Dr. Patrick Hederachi of the Civil Engineering Faculty at the University of Calgary. Next, a step back in time to the early days of Alberta's oil patch. During the 1920s and 30s, life in Alberta's oil patch was much harder than today. Yet despite the poor living conditions and daily risks to life and limb, young men clamored to work on the oil rigs. As historian Dr. Sandy Gow discovered in his research, sometimes the attraction was money, but sometimes it was as basic as food and shelter.
You had to take a look at what they were able to find for work at that particular time. For example, after World War I, when drilling picked up in southern Alberta, what could a young man, do? Well, he could work as a farm laborer. He could find some sort of rough, unskilled trade job working in a sawmill or a flour mill or something like that, or he might find a construction job. There wasn't much status attached to these, and it was a pretty deadening job with lots of chances of losing your pay because you got laid off. But in the oil patch, as it was emerging then, you could make a great deal more money. In 1924, a driller could hope to receive as much as $250 a month. That was about $8.30 a shift, and the shift was roughly 12 hours at that time, to change to 8 later on. If he was a person called a tool dresser who banged out the bits and straightened them up and that, he could earn $150 a month. The real creme de la creme were on the drilling rig floor. They got paid the highest. And, of course, the driller made the highest of everybody because he was a supervisor. And certain men who were specialists, like what they called the cathead men who ran the capstan, who wound wire up and down, and the derrick men who stood up on the derrick, they got an extra $25 a month because they were classified as specialists. The higher up you went, the more you could demand for a wage. The one man who said that he thought he was sort of in clover was a man by the name of Tiny Bevins, and as late as 1940, he could rent a whole house for $30 a month. And he thought that his wages of about $200 a month were tremendous. But, of course, the Depression really knocked a hole in these wages. The biggest place for drilling at that time in the Depression, the busiest place was Turner Valley, and then to a lesser extent Wainwright. But many oil companies went under, and they simply didn't have enough to continue paying salaries. And those who remained still operative. And so what they did was they promised a man, if you come to work for us and we strike oil, we'll pay you your wages when we strike oil. And these were called no-jack jobs. And the money you would get, no-jack because there was no money, the money you would get when the oil well was drilled ended up being called hold-back money. Now, some people got paid their hold-back money when the well hit oil. Others didn't get anything because the owners jerked them around for ages, and they never did get their money out of them. But one man that I came across recalls that it took 3 years, but the company came through and paid him all his hold-back money. But then there, of course, were the holes that went dry. And so a man might work on those old drill rigs, those old standard drill rigs, which often were over a hole for sometimes up to a year, would work that whole year for nothing. He wouldn't get paid for anything because the company didn't have it to pay. Very often the company went into receivership. But what was amazing was somebody else would walk up with a bit of money and they'd buy that rig and they'd move it to another space, another location in the Turner Valley area, and they'd start drilling it all over again. And so the men would sign up for another no-jack job in hope that the new hole would pay off.
It makes you really wonder why they would even stay with it.
Well, for some of them, the money that they could make with a good hole when they were making money was better than they could make, say, in 6 months or a year as a farm laborer. A number of people during the Depression whose farms packed in went to Turner Valley in hopes of surviving by finding some kind of job in the oil business. And it was very interesting that the Royal Idaho Oil Company, which is a subsidiary of Imperial Oil, had a conscious program of trying to employ as many people as they could on a day basis to try and give, I guess you could say it was welfare, to try and give welfare to people, especially those with families. So they took them in turn and gave them a day's work and then paid them. And then they'd come in each day and they'd queue up and wait for another job to try and get enough money together. So the company actually had make work projects. It had producing wells, so of course it was selling gas and oil, but it also needed to drill new ones. And if they could give you a job, they would. And I think that's a pretty humanitarian thing to have happening during the Depression. And so Turner Valley became sort of almost a mecca for people looking for work. And a number of them, of course, lost their farms during the Depression. They lost them to the banks.
And I guess, too, then, if they were working, but even though they weren't getting paid at some of these no-jack jobs, at least they were still getting their food and shelter.
Oh, yes, very much. They were at least still getting food, the quality of which was not necessarily the best. But, yes, they had shelter. They had they even had some place to try and wash their clothes, and something as basic as that we wouldn't even think of today, because some of them had to live very rough. Turner Valley, there was a place called Hell's Half Acre where a number of the oil wells vented their gas into a coulee and lit it on fire, and it burnt year-round. And this particular place changed the environment because, of course, it was warm all the time. And birds that would normally go south and so forth would stay there, but men out of work would go there to sleep because they wouldn't freeze to death. And Hell's Half Acre kept some people alive, kept some families alive even, because often a man would show up with his family with them. And they had absolutely nothing but a few dollars in their pocket.
That was Dr. Sandy Gao, a history professor at Concordia University College in Edmonton. Sandy is writing a book on changes in oil field technology. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this heritage segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Good night.